Welcome to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. I'm Michael Lucchese, and on with me today is Dr. Stephen F. Hayward, who is a visiting scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of a two-volume political biography titled The Age of Reagan, and also of a new book out called Patriotism is Not Enough, Harry Jaffa, Walter Burns, and the Arguments That Redefined American Conservatism. Dr. Hayward, it's great to have you on.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So my first question today is, who were Harry Jaffa and Walter Burns? What did they argue about? And why is that important to conservatives today?
Right. Well, those are big questions. Harry Jaffa and Walter Burns were both prominent conservative political scientists who died coincidentally on the same day, just a year and a half ago, which kind of reminded me of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams dying on the same day in 1826. You know, sort of remarkable coincidence. They agreed on a lot of things. They're both, I think it should be said, were students of Leo Strauss back in the 1940s and 1950s. And each made a big mark on political science and political thought in ways I can describe. But they also had a long, bitter feud with one another that I always thought was unfortunate. And although it had some substantive disagreements, like some academic feuds, it turned personal and, you know, they started throwing insults at each other. And I think that was unfortunate. Because there's a lot to be learned from both of them, and I decided to write a sort of an intellectual biography of the two of them side by side, because I'm one of the few persons who knew them both. There's people who are students of Jaffa, including several people on the Hillsdale faculty, and then there are a lot of other people who are students of Walter Burns at either Cornell University or Georgetown University, where he taught for many years. And I was lucky enough to get to know both of them and like both of them a lot, and regret that they feuded. And I guess I'll just say there's a lot to their feud, but I'll say it turned partly on how the American founding should be understood. Harry Jaffa thought that the American founding should be understood more in its classical dimensions. I mean, Jaffa thought that there was great nobility in the American founding, that you could make out Aristotelian elements in America. And Walter Burns inclined to a more modern view, that it was purely modern liberal individualism, which is decent and provides for stability, but is not always necessarily the most worthy or admirable of countries, because liberal individualism is indeed a problem for our time. So that's my opening remarks about it, but there's a lot more parts to it that I can get into.
Absolutely. You mentioned Leo Strauss earlier on in your response to that question. And in the book, you quote Strauss as saying, the crisis of the West consists in the West having become uncertain of its purpose. What would Burns and Jaffa, what would they say the West's purpose is, and how did we lose sight of that?
Right. Well, I think that the central insight of Strauss and many of his students was that the great problem of the modern age, modern starting with, you know, the Enlightenment or certainly Nietzsche, is nihilism, right? That there's no foundation for any moral teaching or any moral view. This is where one place where Jaffa and Burns agreed with their great teacher Strauss, that you could indeed find a ground for human morality and therefore a ground for decent politics in the idea of human nature, in the idea of human excellence, as it's understood, for example, in Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, but also from the Christian tradition of the New Testament. That an awful lot of modern thought is directed to rubbishing both reason and revelation as authoritative sources for understanding how human beings should live and organize our social life. I think one of the things that's interesting about not just Jaffa and Burns, but a whole lot of other students of Strauss, is that while Strauss is mostly interested himself in studying the classics and European thinkers, a lot of his students, especially Jaffa and Burns, but also Martin Diamond and Herb Storing and a number of other people I mentioned in the book, directed their attention wholly at, or almost wholly at, America. And they did more to revive the serious study of the American founding than I think any set of scholars really since the founders. They take seriously the idea that James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, and, you know, the other founders had things to teach us today, not just as a matter of historical curiosity, but in fact they had enduring and permanent insights in the nature of human life, and that we shouldn't simply dismiss them just because they lived and wrote 230 years ago, and we think we're so much smarter than they are these days.
This is Michael Lucchese for Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. Right now, we have Steve Hayward, the author of a new book titled Patriotism is Not Enough, Harry Jaffa, Walter Burns, and the Arguments That Redefined American Conservatism. In the book, you also talk a lot about the idea of statesmanship. and this idea that there might be some kind of a conflict between political philosophy and political action. Could you talk a little bit about that controversy and what Burns and Jaffa both have to say about it?
Right. Well, that operates on two levels. One is simply political science methodology of these of the current age. You know, political science at most universities, not at Hillsdale, thankfully enough, but at most universities, political science these days has been reduced to quantitative modeling, regression analysis, you know, things you can count. And there's some value in that, but that's become the whole of political science. And it is increasingly remote from real political life. And one thing Jaffa and Burns thought, and also following Leo Strauss, is that in fact, if you want to understand political life, we ought to study statesmen. It means, you know, George Washington, Winston Churchill, Abraham Lincoln, and even bad models of statesmen, or, you know, not Bismarck is not necessarily a bad model, but, you know, we ought to study tyrants like Hitler and Stalin. Not to emulate them, of course, but to understand how politics goes wrong, especially in the age of utopian ideologies. So one of the things Walter Burns said to me, well, in fact, our last conversation we had over the phone was that, as he put it, the proper method for the study of politics is biography. Well, almost nobody does that in political science, as I say, except at rare places like Hillsdale. The other part of your question is about conflict between political philosophy and political action. And, you know, that gets back to a very old argument about whether philosophy is purely, whether the highest life is purely in contemplation of the eternal things. That might have been Socrates or Plato as they started out. And whether philosophy needs to make a turn towards its practical applications in the real world. And that's what gives you political philosophy. You know, that's a sort of a recondite argument, but it's not a new one. As I say, it goes back at least to the ancient Greeks. And Burns and Jaffa, although they had some quarrels about this point, I think they both thought that political philosophy needed to inform statesmen, that you couldn't get too far away from understanding and grappling with the theoretical problems of political life. And although those are difficult problems and sometimes very hard to work out even at the level of theory, we need to be oriented towards keeping those problems in front of us as we try and make our way in a practical sense in the real world with our institutions and our laws and our philosophies of individual rights and foreign policy, for that matter.
So you say, in the title, you say that Burns and Jaffa redefined American conservatism. How did they redefine American conservatism in terms of this statesman idea of statesmanship, which you've been communicating? Have conservative politicians taken up the sort of charge that Jaffa and Burns led, or have they mostly ignored it?
I think they have. I should describe how I think they changed it. It's not so much on the statesmanship point alone. That's actually something of an ancillary point. I think the argument that I make in the book and elsewhere, and I'm not alone in making this argument, is that American conservatism, especially when it reemerged as a self-conscious movement in the 1950s with things like National Review magazine and Russell Kirk's great book, The Conservative Mind, it really was in a lot of ways European in character, you know, appealing to tradition. All of which is fine, by the way. I mean, those are, you know, Edmund Burke is the leading figure. But of course, I think American conservatism, or their point is that there's actually a distinctly American tradition that can be appealed to. Just to pick one example, you know, in the Constitution, we forbid any titles of nobility, right? We take seriously the idea of the equality of individual rights and the Declaration of Independence. Europeans, you know, they still, even today, although they're very liberal, they still have, you know, class consciousness. You still have titles of nobility in England and some other European countries. You still have constitutional monarchies, right? And we're a pure republic. And the point is that that in America we had our own tradition that could be developed. That's different from Burke's purely evolutionary conservative tradition that he lays out in, you know, his famous letter on the Reflections on the Revolution in France. So I think that's what's new and distinct. I think it should be added that one of the things that I realized in doing my background research for this is that people like Jaffa and Burns and that whole Strauss circle in the 50s, they were all thought of themselves as liberal Democrats at the time. Leo Strauss and I think both Burns and Jaffa all voted for Adlai Stevenson in the 50s. But what I think they came to see is that the liberals' account, meaning, you know, the liberalism of Arthur Schlesinger and the dominant figures of the 50s, that their account of the American founding was superficial and deficient, and that it needed to be more robust. And that's where I say they changed American conservatism by making us self-consciously go back and recall the principles of the American founding and amplify them a lot. And I do think they have succeeded in changing the views of at least many office holders. And maybe my favorite example is Ronald Reagan, of whom I've written at great length about. You know, he talked about the Constitution and the founding more often than most other modern American presidents ever. And I quote somebody anonymously in the book, and I'm going to keep this person anonymous, who remarked to me a few years ago that, you know, gosh, even as late as Ronald Reagan, late for me, it's my lifetime, right? As late as Ronald Reagan, it wasn't clear what direction the conservative movement might take. It might have gone, he said, in, you know, Russell Kirk's sort of traditionalist direction, or it could have gone in a Milton Friedmanite libertarian direction, but it really went in the direction of people like Jaffe and Burns, who said we ought to anchor our conservatism in the principles of the American founding. And, I mean, those other schools still exist and are very important and very useful, but I think they're right about how, as someone on Wall Street might say, people like Burns and Jaffe and their friends rebalanced the American conservative intellectual portfolio.
In the book, you talk, you devote an entire chapter to the administrative state, which is something conservatives have been talking a lot about recently. I know that Donald Trump, in his inauguration address, he said that one of his goals as president is to transfer power from Washington to the people. How do you think Jaffe and Burns would advise President Trump to go about doing that? How would they advise us taking on the administrative state as conservatives?
Yeah, well, I think they would, you know, they would tell him and his associates like Steve Bannon, who talked about wanting to deconstruct the administrative state, first of all, to keep talking that way, keep reminding citizens that they're supposed to rule the country, not the administrators, not the bureaucrats and the permanent bureaucracy in Washington. And I think this is a remarable thing. One of the things I argue about in that chapter is that the administrative state is not the same thing as just a big lumbering bureaucracy. It's not about the size of government. It's about the form of rule. I mean, it really raises the oldest political question, which is who should rule. And the theory of the administrative state, and this doesn't originate with me. You've got some people there at Hillsdale have some great work on this, like John Marini, who I know visits from time to time, and Tom West and others, is the idea was starting 100 years ago with Woodrow Wilson is that the experts should rule. The administrators should rule. They should be a permanent governing class isolated from the reach of popular majorities. And, you know, it's deeply anti-democratic. It's deeply against the principles of the Constitution, like the separation of powers, for example. And as I argue in the book, conservatives were slow to perceive this, I think. You know, again, that 1950s generation of conservatives, they worried about the New Deal and the Cold War, and they should have. But I think they missed the deeper transformations that have been wrought by the progressives in our constitutionalism. So to come back to your narrower question, what should Trump do? He should reestablish the separation of powers. He's taking some steps to do that. You know, that's sort of step number one. The nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court looks very promising to me because it seems like his views on these questions are very sound. And then Congress, I think, needs to be reformed some, and that's a harder problem. But so far, I think the Trump people understand the problem, and I think they just keep carrying on what they're doing. And as I say, it's amazing to me that this phrase, that administrative state, which used to be kind of a recondite phrase of just a handful of political scientists, is now out in the general world. I mean, I had the National Public Radio call me up a couple weeks ago and say, what is this whole thing? We don't understand it, which is typical of liberals. And so it's interesting that that is now a mainstream term, which again shows you the impact that our little circle of political thinkers is having.
Another chapter you write in the book is devoted to the idea of political equality. And particularly, I know that this was an issue that was very close to Harry Jaffa's heart. In Crisis of the House Divided and other books and essays that Jaffa wrote on Lincoln, he wrote about Lincoln's idea of equality and contrasted it to some extent with Stephen A. Douglas's democratic majoritarianism. How in the matrix of consent and equality, how does that all work out? How would Jaffe say that all works out?
Yeah, this is the single most difficult part of I think of Jaffa's teaching. You know, he argued very directly that equality, as it's expressed or understood in the Declaration of Independence, is a conservative principle. And, you know, a lot of conservatives have been equivocal or ambivalent about the Declaration of Independence because that phrase, all men are created equal, is so susceptible of abuse by modern egalitarians, you know, modern radicals. And This is something that's not new with our generation or even with Jaffa's, but Tocqueville pointed out this problem, that it would be the central problem of American politics, is that equality wouldn't be confined to or couldn't be confined to just equal rights before the law, and then rights understood as natural rights, not just any old right anyone can think of, any old demand or claim that anyone can think of. But that's where we are today, is it's very hard to get a clear focus on what equality is and what it isn't in America's founding thought. Jaffa dramatized it in his famous book, Crisis of the House Divided, as the clash between Stephen Douglas and Lincoln in the great debates of 1858. But, you know, today we have a very serious problem. You know, I hear people say, health care should be a fundamental human right. Which means what? A judge can order us to provide health care to everybody or can tell Congress what it has to do? I mean, it seems to be the logic of it. And so that's always been a difficulty with the idea of equality, is that it won't stay confined to its proper bounds. I'm not sure Jaffa ever had a completely clear or effective answer for that. I mean, I think his logic and his reasoning was very good, but it's difficult. It takes a while to trace through. And what that means, it's difficult in the mass political market that we live in today. So there's our dilemma, is equal natural rights is a very important and central idea to America, but the idea of equality has been hijacked by the left very effectively for decades now. This is not a brand new problem. We're always fighting a rearguard action against the left and the predations they make on all the rest of us in the name of equality. I'll just add quickly that while Jaffa thought equal was the most important word in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, Walter Burns differed from him in thinking the most important word was secure. Remember, the Declaration goes on a couple sentences later and says, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. And what Burns meant was simply what Hobbes meant, which is all these declarations of rights aren't worth anything if there isn't a competent government to secure them through the rule of law, through constitutionalism. So that's why he put a little different emphasis on, you might say, the prudence of the matter, again, pointing us back to the necessity of statesmanship.
At one point in the book, you bring up the fact that Jaffa considered the Voting Rights Act of the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement as a sort of conservative political accomplishment. And I know that in contemporary political discourse, that's not necessarily something that comes to most people's mind when they think about Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. What would Jaffa have to say? Why did Jaffa say that that was a conservative political victory? And is that connected to his idea of equality at all?
It is, although, you know, he did change his mind a little bit in the last decade of his life about the Civil Rights Act in particular. I'll come back to all that. I mean, his point was... he said something interesting, really, about the Voting Rights Act, which was that should have been the first piece of legislation. Because remember, one of the problems in the South was that blacks were simply denied the right to vote. And, you know, as Martin Luther King put it in his famous letter from the Birmingham jail, how can we be said to have consented to the laws when we had no voice in the making of them, right? I mean, it's a very good, and King, remember, drew upon, you know, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution in the ways that a lot of people today, like, say, Black Lives Matter, do not. I mean, King made a natural law argument in that famous letter from the jail, which is why I think you can read that document as a conservative document. So what Jaffa thought was, one of the remedies for oppression of blacks in the South in the Jim Crow era would have been to give them the right to vote so their voices would be heard at the ballot box. And then as far as the Civil Rights Act goes, you know, the barring of discrimination, I don't think there's many people who disagree with that idea, at least in the abstract. Jaffa did come to regret, not his support for the act, but the fact that the Civil Rights Act has been corrupted and turned into a regime of quotas in hiring. I mean, they deny that, but it is how it works often. Affirmative action admissions in universities, he thought all that was a dreadful offense against equality, rightly understood. But he certainly thought the principle of trying to find some laws to remedy deliberate discrimination, mostly by the Democratic Party, of course, it should be said, was something that conservatives should applaud. And he was not, by the way, the only conservative who thought that. Wilmore Kendall, who I talk about in the book, also had the same view about that matter. And you hardly find someone more conservative than Kendall was. And so there is an irony, I'll just end with this answer to this, is that you know, one of the great opponents of the Civil Rights Act in 64 was Barry Goldwater, although he only opposed one part of the act, and that was the employment discrimination part, which he said would be unenforceable, as well as maybe unconstitutional. And yet Jaffa was writing speeches for Goldwater and supporting him for president for that year. So despite that difference, Jaffa was an enthusiastic backer of Goldwater.
Well, thank you so much for being on, Dr. Hayward. Stephen F. Hayward, visiting scholar at the Institute of Government Studies at the University of California. You can follow him at Twitter or on Twitter at Stephen F. Hayward with a V. He is the author of Patriotism is Not Enough, Harry Jaffa, Walter Burns, and the Arguments That Redefined American Conservatism, which you can purchase at Amazon.com or any other fine bookseller. You're listening to the Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.